Now, the latest in our series, My Guilty Pleasure, where writers talk about books they're embarrassed to admit they love. Today, an erotic novel of exacting historical detail set during the English Civil War of the 1640s. The book is called As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann. Here's author Lionel Shriver to explain why it is her guilty pleasure.
I remember when I first idly opened As Meat Loves Salt over my morning coffee. I had other plans for that day, yet after about 10 pages, I put those plans aside, indulging myself. I curled into a living room armchair and galloped on as the sun rose high. In my easily distracted adulthood, I have rarely, alas, said this of any novel, but I could not put it down. As Meat Loves Salt is narrated by a brooding, intermittently violent young man named Jacob, who does not know himself. In flight from a murder and a brief disastrous marriage, he joins the New Model Army, led by the parliamentarian Oliver Cromwell, from which he and his new friend Ferris eventually go AWOL. It isn't until halfway through the novel that Jacob realizes, and we realize, that the tension between Jacob and Ferris is sexual, and they embark upon a torrid affair. Yet in the 1640s, the mild, accepting term gay had yet to be coined. Bookshops didn't have whole sections cheerfully devoted to gay literature. Rather, homosexuality was a hanging offense. Jacob and Ferris's passionate, fractious relationship courts calamity. I happen to be straight and female. Yet McCann's novel, to my incredulity, her first, is one of the most erotic I have ever read. But it isn't, like so much erotic literature, embarrassing. Her language is carefully couched in the terms of the time, without ever seeming fusty, coy, or obscure. We know perfectly well what she means when she writes, "His blood was up." Moreover, the historical details are seamlessly interwoven into the text, and rather than seem to show off how much homework the author has done, they create the sense of immediacy that I always need to get hooked by a historical novel. After all, the past was once the present. Thus McCann has written a tony version of We Were There at the English Civil War. Ever since reading this book, I felt curiously proprietary about the conflict, as if I truly know what it was like, as if I were there. Apparently Maria McCann was a schoolteacher when she wrote this novel, and used to get up at 5 a.m. every weekday to write a few more pages. But so professional was her work that when her editor showed her manuscript to an expert on the period, the only error the historian discovered was a particular postal vehicle, which wasn't used until a few years later. That's pretty high marks.
The book is called As Meat Loves Salt by Maria McCann. It's the guilty pleasure of Lionel Shriver, whose latest novel is titled So Much for That.
What to cook? Something familiar or something surprising? Cookbooks abound with ideas for menu planning, and food writer Susan Chang is back to talk about the best of them. She's at member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Leanne. Great to be back.
Nice to have you back for Thanksgiving. As you know, as we all know, the foundation of many Thanksgiving meals is the turkey. What's the best recipe you found in these cookbooks?
Well, personally, I'm not making the turkey this year, so that's lucky for me, but all I have to make is pie. But if I were making the turkey, the one I'd want to do is from the New York Times cookbook. It's called A Roasted Brine-Cured Turkey with Wild Mushroom Stuffing, and there's some nice, slightly contrarian touches in the brine that are fennel, star anise, coriander. So if you happen to have about 72 hours on your hands, that's the one to do. You'll have to start tonight.
Yes. I love that New York Times cookbook because now I feel I can toss away all my newspaper clippings with the recipes I've
right.
collected for the years. Have you seen any or you know, some interesting choices for main dishes?
Well, yes. I've seen some other interesting choices that are not Thanksgiving-oriented per se, but they're things I'd do if I were expecting company. Stewy, braisy type things that kind of give you the freedom not to fuss when the guests are arriving. Let's see, in Dory Greenspan's Around My French Table, there's a wonderful lamb and dried apricot tagine, kind of a stew, absolutely delicious. In Melissa Clark's In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite, there's a braised flanken with pomegranate seeds. Beautiful to look at and delicious to eat.
Mm. A flanken is what, meat?
Yes, that's a beef short rib, but it's cross-cut so that it softens up a lot more easily in the pot.
Now, can anyone make these dishes, or are there degrees of difficulty?
Well, this year there are some slow recipes, but not so much difficult recipes. I think they take, you know, not so much skill as commitment. I mean, there's hardly anything I can commit to do for 72 hours. But in general, this year's recipes, they look kind of longer and harder than they really are because these authors actually take the trouble to tell you everything you need to know to do the recipe. You know, it's those short, cute cookbooks with almost nothing on the page. Those are the ones you have to watch out for because they'll double cross you.
Huh. As opposed to one big table, which has 600 recipes from home cooks. It doesn't seem like you can go wrong there. Farmers, fishermen, pitmasters, and chefs.
Yeah, I was just blown away by that book. It's huge. It's splendidly diverse. There's recipes from home cooks all over the country. And I don't know how much shoe leather Molly O'Neill wore out tracking down these recipes, but I know it took her 10 years. It's just great journalism.
Wow. Was 2010 a good year for cookbooks?
Oh, unbelievable. I mean, Leanne, I just totally agonized over this year's choices. I mean, it's never not hard, but this year it was like Clash of the Titans. There are just so many once-in-a-lifetime books this year, and there were whole categories of wonderful books I couldn't even include, you know, beautiful coffee table books. I just wanted to stick to the books that everyday cooks would want to use every day, and there's so many of them. I mean, I want to make every recipe in these books, and even just in my top 10, that would be like 3,000 recipes. It would take me 8 years.
Well, what about these cookbooks as gifts? I mean, do you give them to someone who's going to cook the recipes, or do you give them to someone because the cookbook looks nice and it's nice to read?
Well, there's a bit of both this year, which is kind of nice. For other people this year, I would give them like the Gourmet Cookie Book. It's a little book. It's adorable. It's got pictures of the best cookie from each year for the last, I don't know, 60, 70 years, however long it was that Gourmet was in business. I would definitely give people One Big Table because it'll be great bedtime reading straight through spring. And for myself, you know, it's kind of funny. I would choose the Food Substitutions Bible because if you're a cook and you want one book that's always going to be in your kitchen and help you out, you want the Food Substitutions Bible.
I love that because 6,500 substitutions for ingredients, equipment, and techniques. How many times have we approached a recipe and we're missing like one thing? And it's usually buttermilk.
That's right. And then you decide not to do it.
Right.
Which is just silly.
Right. Very silly. You know, there often can be too many well-meaning cooks in the kitchen during the holiday, and, you know, broths are in danger of spoiling. Are there tasks that you can actually delegate to others? I mean, both to adults and children?
Sure, sure. I mean, ideally, yeah, you want just one person on the stove or the oven or whatever it is. But you want other people sitting around the table keeping the cook company and doing kind of easy prep stuff. So if it's grown-ups, you can ask them to crack nuts. You can ask them to trim beans. You can definitely put them in charge of the drinks. You can make them tell you funny stories so you don't get bored. But if you're dealing with kids, well, it's not the best day to teach kids how to cook. I mean, I've got two kids, and it's the one day I do not want to see them in the kitchen. So like a day or two before, yeah, invite them in, have them bake pies, have them bake cookies with you so they can show off on Thanksgiving Day. You know, hey, I made these. Not the day of.
Mm. What's the best survival tip for a holiday cook?
Three words. Plan way ahead. It's pretty much common sense. You know, you can have people bring dessert and salad because salad is a huge kitchen counter hog when you're assembling it. Choose sides you can make the day before. Do not cook showstoppers that you have never tried to cook before. Do not plan to use your oven for anything but the bird, because you don't want to open that door if you don't have to. And let's see, put somebody you trust in charge of last-minute cleaning, pouring the drinks, setting the table, everything except cooking. And if people want to do dishes, let them.
What pies are you making?
I am making apple pie. I am making a cranberry orange pear pie. I am making a nata pie, which is a chocolate tart, because I need my chocolate. And I don't know what pie number 4 is yet. I'll take suggestions.
To see Susie's list of cookbooks, you can go to npr.org. Susie Chang is a food writer and a regular contributor to NPR's Kitchen Window. She joined us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks, Susie. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Leanne.
So I'm here to tell you everything is A-OK, okay?
Okay, 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 okay. It's not right, but it's okay.
Okay, it's okay, it's okay, okay. Okay, 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 okay,
okay, you get the picture, right? This is the world's most popular word. Well, at least that's what Alan Metcalf claims, and he should know, okay? He's written a book simply titled Okay, and it's the story of what he calls America's greatest word. Okay, Alan, you there?
I'm here.
You okay?
I'm okay. I hope you're okay.
I'm okay. So okay began as a joke, I gather, in a newspaper?
It was the craziest thing. On the 23rd of March, 1839, in the Boston Morning Post, it was part of an elaborate joke that the editor was perpetrating on another editor. They had a lot of abbreviations that they were using and made up on the spot and thought they were terrifically funny. And OK was an abbreviation for all correct.
This appears in the newspaper in 1839, O.K. in parentheses, all correct.
That's correct. And it was just one of many abbreviations. If it hadn't been for some amazing coincidences, we would never be saying okay nowadays.
And so there were plenty of these coincidences that you describe in your book. First, let me ask you about Martin Van Buren. See, because I used to hear the story that he actually is the guy that invented the word. How does this word become associated with Martin Van Buren? Because normally I think, you know, mutton chops.
Well, it happens that Martin Van Buren came from Kinderhook, New York. And he got the nickname Old Kinderhook, and early in 1840, OK clubs sprung up with the slogan, OK is OK. So taking that funny little word and making it a mainstay of the political conversation in 1840, suddenly OK was way OK.
And did he used to sign his documents OK, right?
That is a myth, and it was supposedly Andrew Jackson, who signed his documents OK. Early in that election year of 1840, one of Martin Van Buren's opponents, who also opposed Jackson because they both were Democrats, claimed that Andrew Jackson had been a terrible speller, and so he would get a document, and when he approved it, he would write O period K period on it, indicating that it was all correct. Now, that's a total hoax. Andrew Jackson was a good speller. But because of that, somebody at some time within 20 years began writing OK on documents. They began using OK on telegraph lines for approval, and the telegraph was invented around the same time as OK.
And that was obviously the perfect medium to use OK because you had to spit something out in a pretty short space.
Absolutely. They even used OK as a technical term for properly laying the Atlantic cable in 1866.
So it was sort of like the early form of a text message, right? Like an LOL or an OMG?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, I'm okay with those.
Now, if you flip through, you know, pages of some of the better 19th century authors, American authors, you won't find OK in the works of, like, Mark Twain or Bret Hart. I mean, when did people start to accept that OK was OK to use?
It is amazing that in the 19th century, even though OK was being used, all the good authors seemed to avoid it. Louisa May Alcott used OK once in Little Women, and in the next edition of that, she changed OK to cozy.
Cozy?
Of all things. Cozy, because
like
somehow
I'm cozy?
I'm cozy with that instead of I'm OK with that, which indicates that there was something uncomfortable about it. I think it had to do with forgetting the funny origins of OK. forgetting that it stood for all correct. So by the time President Woodrow Wilson came along, he thought it had really come from a Choctaw Indian word, which he spelled O-K-E-H, which was their equivalent of something like OK. It wasn't, but when you have a president of the United States, the only president who had a PhD, write OK on documents, then it was kind
then
of
okay
to say OK.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are the reason OK is so important is that it's the American philosophy in two ways embodied in just two letters. And one is the American philosophy of pragmatism. If something's OK, that's OK. It'll work. Maybe it's not perfect, but it'll work. And that's an American attitude. And the other is that incredible statement, the only famous quotation using OK, which is, "I'm OK, you're OK." That's from the Thomas Harris book of 1967. Based on that, "I'm okay, you can be different than me, and you're okay, that's okay." I think our country is a lot more tolerant now than it used to be.
When you were writing this book, Alan, did you ever find yourself noticing when you said okay? Because when I got this book and I started to read it, I found myself hearing every time I say okay.
Yes, I find myself noticing it now and then. It is so pervasive that we don't notice it. And I do think we should really celebrate OK Day on the 23rd of March every year.
Wait, hold on. OK Day, 23rd of March? Where'd that come out of?
Well, it was the 23rd of March in 1839 when OK was first invented.
Who created OK Day?
Well, I'm creating OK Day.
OK.
And the nice thing is on OK Day, I'd like everybody to go around saying OK. And I'm sure that they will because they say OK every day.
That's the 23rd of March, 2011 is going to be. Is this the first annual OK Day?
I guess it is.
Okay, we'll do it. That's Alan Metcalf. He's an English professor at McMurray College in Illinois. His new book is called OK, The Improbable Story of America's Greatest Word. I'm actually convinced now. Professor Metcalf, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Laura Hillenbrand writes big, great books about exceptional athletes that the world sometimes forgets. Seabiscuit appeared in 2001 and has been on bestseller lists ever since. Now she's written the story of Louis Zamperini, a former Olympic runner who became an American airman. But the true laurels he would win were the result of trials, endurance, and will far from any stadium. Louis Zamperini became a bombardier whose plane disappeared in the Pacific Ocean in 1943. He survived sharks, starvation, and strafing only to be rescued by a Japanese boat. Spent the rest of the war in prison camps and endured cruelty so profound it's painful to repeat. The story of Louis Zamperini's extraordinary survival in the contest of life is at the heart of Laura Hillenbrand's new book, Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. We joined Laura Hillenbrand at her home last week.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Louis Zamperini, he was spirited to the point of delinquency as a kid in Torrance, California.
He was the artful dodger of his hometown from a very early age. He was a serial runaway. He was a brawler. He was a prankster. He stole anything edible he could find. He would break into housewives' kitchens and steal their food just before it was going to go on the table. He was a very difficult boy. I think he was a challenge for his parents.
But running saved him.
Running saved him. He was strong-armed into it by his brother, who recognized that he had the one thing that a good thief has, getaway speed. And it turned out Louis had world-class, historic speed and would become the fastest high school runner in history and a man that everybody thought was going to get the four-minute mile.
Louis Zamperini becomes a bombardier during World War II, serving in the Pacific. It's extraordinary how you recount how truly deadly the air war in the Pacific was, almost aside from combat.
It was incredibly dangerous just to fly these bombers. 15,000 Air Corps trainees died in training stateside. And then once you got into the combat theaters, 36,000 airmen died in non-combat accidents. And that was because there were problems with the planes. Navigation was really difficult. And it's really hard to find little flat islands in these huge, huge oceans with the equipment they had at the time. So it was extremely deadly just to fly in these things, much less go into combat.
So in May 1943, Louis and his crew fly a plane called the Green Hornet, not even their plane, which is under repair, to look for a downed plane. The Green Hornet began to fall apart, and they ditched. Help us understand how daunting it was to find the wreckage of a ditch plane in 1943.
The odds of being rescued if you ended up on a life raft were terrible. It was very, very hard to find people. The rafts were very poorly equipped. The raft that Louis ended up on was especially badly equipped. It had a few cans of water and a few bars of chocolate. It had no knife. And for some reason, it had a set of pliers and screwdrivers. And Louis sat there looking at that thinking, why do I need a set of screwdrivers on a raft? They were in desperate, desperate trouble the minute they hit the water.
How did they live?
It took a lot of ingenuity to stay alive, just the physical part of it. One of the things Louis did is there were air pumps on the rafts in case they sprung leaks, and he took the cases that they came in and made little rain catchers out of them. And because whitecaps kept slopping over the edge of the raft and spoiling the water, because you couldn't drink any seawater, he couldn't just hold the water in the bowls. He would have to constantly suck it out and spit it into the little cans of water they had in the raft, and that's how they hydrated themselves. They barely got along that way. And in terms of food, a few birds landed on their heads, and they caught them. Louis actually used his lieutenant's pin as a fish hook. He tied fish hooks to his finger and grabbed a fish once, and they actually wrestled sharks onto the raft and killed them with the pliers.
They were rescued by a Japanese boat. Crew kind of identified with them and treated them well, but then they were sent to prison camps.
They were held in cells that Louis referred to as a dungeon. And their food was balls of rice that was thrown in onto the floor, and there was feces on the floor, and there were maggots, and they would have to pick the rice out. Their water was a tiny cup of tea every day. They were so desperate, they wished they were back out on the raft.
And, of course, they were beaten.
They were beaten. Medical experiments were conducted on them. And they were actually very fortunate to survive them because the Japanese conducted medical experiments on tens of thousands of people, prisoners of war and civilians, and killed most of them.
We're speaking with Laura Hillenbrand about her new book, Unbroken. I have to ask you about the bird.
The bird was Mutsuhiro Watanabe. The name the bird was given to him by the POWs because Watanabe didn't want to be spoken about, so they chose fake names for all of their captors, and that was his name. And he was a very handsome, very wealthy young man, prominent person in Japanese society. He had failed to make officer himself, and he had an obsession with POWs who had made officer, with those who were prominent in civilian life, and with those who were defiant. Louis was an officer. He was a lieutenant. He was a world-famous Olympian, and he was a ferociously defiant man. And once these two met, it was more or less a showdown for the rest of the war between the two of them. He singled Louis out for terrible brutality, and their relationship would end with a murder plot.
We don't give away anything from the book, but the prisoners decide there must be a way, we're going to kill this man.
Killing this man, yeah.
Even if it means we're going to die, we're going to kill this man.
There was a lot going on with the prisoners of war in terms of maintaining their dignity and finding ways to push back. The most important thing in terms of survival was not being able to eat or drink or sleep or have shelter or to be even healthy. It was to maintain your dignity. And they did that by pushing back. And one of the ways they did that was they hatched a murder plot against this man.
Louis Zamperini returns home to California after the war, and he's lionized as a war hero, deservedly. But the bird stays with him.
Once the war is over, physically, it's not over emotionally, not nearly. And Louis came home a deeply, deeply haunted man, and this manifested itself in the form of nightmares, very vivid, terrible, terrible nightmares where Louis would wake up screaming, and they were generally involving fighting with the bird, being beaten by the bird, or trying to strangle the bird. He actually ended up one night straddling his pregnant wife, waking up, strangling her, thinking she was the bird.
How do we make sense of the fact that somebody who clearly, heroically figured out exactly what he had to do to survive should be so flummoxed by peace?
I think what he was dealing with when he was in crisis in the war, These were all physical things that he had to get over. He had to figure out how to get water on the raft. He had to figure out how to catch that next fish. And these were all kind of immediate concerns that he could deal with physically. And, you know, meanwhile, the damage was being done to him emotionally. It was something I think a lot of these men could kind of put off at the time in the crisis. But once the crisis was over, that's when it all kind of exploded inside them.
Louis Zamperini is still alive.
Yes, he is. Very much so.
And I think, can we say, because it was a big public event, he carried the Olympic torch at one point when the Olympics returned to Japan.
He returned to Japan for the Nagano Olympics in 1998, and he carried the torch through the town of Noetsu, where he had been held prisoner.
And there were people cheering for him.
There were many, many Japanese people cheering for him, and there were actually Japanese soldiers there. There were many children there, and they were all clapping for him and taking pictures of him. And it was a beautiful experience for him to come back and have that closure and have all of that hatred behind him.
I don't think you use the word hero a lot in the book.
I feel like anybody who puts on a uniform and fights for their country is heroic. I mean, that's an amazing self-sacrifice. And I think Louis is definitely a hero. And what he did for this country is something that really moves me. I don't, though, want to separate him from all the other men around him who did the same thing. They're all extraordinary. And I want him to be representative of all of them rather than somebody who stands apart from them.
Laurie Hillenbrand, her new bestseller, Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And to read an excerpt from Unbroken, you can come to our website, npr.org.